This is Lewis Lapham with The World and Time for February 12th. My guest is Anders Halvorsen, molecular biologist and historian, now the author of a book about the rainbow trout that comes with the title An Entirely Synthetic Fish. Your book, Anders, comes not only with a surprising title, but also with an equally surprising subtitle, How Rainbow Trout Beguiled America and Overran the World. Maybe you can begin by telling us about the rainbow trout's current place in the American scheme of things. Where is it to be found, and why is it so highly prized?
Well, rainbow trout can be found virtually everywhere in the United States. There's a few places, of course, in Florida and Louisiana where they haven't done as well. But they've been introduced to every state in the country and to every continent in the world. And why are they so highly prized? They're prized by the fisheries managers tremendously. They're the ones that have really driven this. State and federal fish agencies stock about 1.7 billion fish into the fresh waters of the United States every year. And that's about 40 million pounds of fish, and about half of those are rainbow trout. The managers like them so much because, first of all, rainbow trout are very easy to raise in hatcheries compared to other trout and any other fish. Furthermore, rainbow trout compared to other trout, such as the brown trout and the brook trout, which are the other two most common trout in the country, are sort of the Goldilocks of fish. The brook trout are very easy to catch. They'll strike anything that they see coming down the stream. Brown trout are, they refer to them as being much more educated. They used to talk about them as being the hardest to catch because they're very discriminating. Rainbow trout are right in the middle. They'll strike enough people's flies that people are satisfied with their day on the river, but they don't get fished out nearly as quickly. And on the flip side, the fishermen really love rainbow trout because they're spectacular fighters. They go airborne, unlike many of the other fish. They fight hard. There's all sorts of literature about rainbow trout and how spectacular they are as fighters. And of course, if you buy into the notion that how good of a fighter your quarry is reflects on you, then the rainbow trout hold a very high place.
That leads into the reason for the development of the rainbow trout at the end of the 19th century. People somehow associated it with virility. Explain how that began and how we begin to stock American waters with the rainbow trout.
It's a really fascinating story. So you go back to the middle and end of the 19th century, and America was undergoing a vast and industrial explosion unlike anything that had ever been seen before. And there were a couple of consequences of that. One thing, the fresh waters, all the streams, especially up and down the East Coast, were really hit hard. You had intensive agriculture and logging sending sediment into those streams. You had factories and tanneries and mills using them as unregulated sewers. So, of course, that led to the demise of the fish all up and down the East Coast. The fisheries really took a hit and really disappeared. Now, the other thing that that Industrial Revolution did was it created massive wealth, especially amongst the sort of elites, many of whom tended to be sort of Anglo-Saxon, Northern European white men. And there became an enormous concern amongst all of these white men, if you will, that they were turning into real fops, real dandies. There's a great quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who was the famous justice's father and a famous man in his own right at the time, who wrote that such a set of black-coated, stiff-jointed, soft-muscled, paste-complexioned youth, as we can boast in our Atlantic cities, never before sprang from the loins of Anglo-Saxon lineage. Teddy Roosevelt was the same. He warned that we were committing race suicide. And there was another man named George Perkins Marsh, who's a really fascinating character. But in 1857, he wrote a report for the state of Vermont about the fisheries there and what could be done. And in his report, he, like those other two that I just mentioned, says that American men are becoming duller and more effeminate, and that this is a terrifying prospect because democracy itself will be at risk if that starts to happen to our men. And so what he proposes to do is get men out fishing. He says that's going to make our men virile again, and with virile men, we can save our democracy. The problem was how to get men out fishing if all the fish had disappeared from the rivers. And the answer to that Marsh came up with was to use this new technology that had really just been invented in the last decade, which was the artificial propagation of fish. So people had finally learned how to take the male and female fish, squeeze the eggs and the milk into a pan, raise the fish in a what's really a fish factory. In fact, in France, where they pioneered the process, they referred to them as such. And so he said, well, here's the solution. We have a technological solution. We can just stock the streams with all of these fish. That'll encourage men to get out fishing, and our United States will be safe.
How did they find and where did they come across the rainbow trout?
There were a number of different people working on this, but there was a man named Livingston Stone who traced his roots all the way back to the Mayflower, and he was a minister in a town called Charlestown, New Hampshire. And for some reason or another, he decided to get into fish culture. And he then encouraged the federal government to get into fish culture, along with a number of other people. And the federal government passed a bill that created something called the United States Fish Commission. And the Fish Commission is the direct predecessor to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that we have today.
What year are we talking about here, Anders?
We are talking about 1873. And so Livingston Stone headed out to California into the wilds. Remember, the Transcontinental Railroad had just been completed a few years earlier. He heads out to Northern California above Red Bluff, California, on the McLeod River. And it's an area that most of the streams in California have likewise, by the way, been destroyed because of the hydraulic mining, where they would take these vast fire hoses and just spray down the hillsides, trying to extract what little gold they could find in the riverbanks. And he found one river, the McLeod River, that was still relatively pristine, largely because the Wintu Indians who lived there had defended it quite fiercely. And somehow he managed to convince them to allow him to establish a hatchery there to send back Pacific salmon, with which they intended to restock the streams of the East. And ultimately he found these fish, these rainbow trout, and they became the sort of magical fish. Again, for the reasons I just described to you, they're easy to raise in hatcheries. And on top of that, they could survive conditions that the brook trout, the native brook trout of the East, could not survive. They could survive warmer temperatures, streams with more sediment. And so they very quickly became these very popular fish back east with the hatchery managers. And very quickly, the U.S. Fish Commission built its facilities all over the country to start propagating and stocking these fish.
Now we're in the 1880s, and how are they transported? I mean, it must have been no easy trick without refrigeration.
It was no easy trick. They were transported as eggs and usually stocked as fry. Their goal in that age was to introduce these fish as far and wide as possible. They would transport these fish as eggs back and forth in the country, and they had to keep them cool and on moss, and they took them on railroads, specially designed railroad cars. And it was quite an adventure. At one point, Livingston Stone was transporting some fish across the country, and the bridge gave way underneath the train, killing quite a few people. The train fell into the river. Stone and his companions did survive, but there were some pretty epic adventures that they had. And likewise, in the wilds in California, there were, they had to take the stagecoach to get around. The stagecoach was frequently robbed by outlaws. The Indians were usually didn't pose a problem, but occasionally they did. There were mountain lions, everything you can imagine. So there were some incredible stories. And Livingston Stone is an incredible storyteller. He really reminds me as sort of the word version of Albert Bierstadt and Thomas Moran. He told these amazing stories about what the West was like that must have enamored the people back east, especially the congressmen that he was sort of writing to and trying to impress so that they would provide him with more money to stock these fish.
Yes, and we have to remember that the 1870s, 1876 is the Battle of the Little Bighorn, so the Indians are still abroad, the buffalo are still on the plains, and the fish by the end of the, I think you say in your book that by the end of the 19th century, the rainbow trout has been introduced into almost every state that was then in the Union, as well as into a number of foreign countries.
That's right. It was that was really the golden era. And there was a big movement called the acclimatizing movement that was all around the country and all around the world. It originated in France and spread to England and spread to the United States. And the idea was not to move domesticated species around the world, but actually to move wild species around the world. So they would try to bring the French tried to bring yaks and tapirs to all of the far corners of their empire. The British tried to do, they were a little more subdued about it, but they still brought animals all over the place. They introduced brown trout to many of their colonies. And you had the same thing going on in the United States. In fact, the reason we have starlings, which are a very common bird all throughout the United States now, in the United States at all today, is because there was a drug magnate from New York City who was afraid that Americans were going to be culturally impoverished unless we had all of the birds that were mentioned in Shakespeare. And so because there's one throwaway line regarding a starling in one of Shakespeare's plays, we now have, he imported these starlings to the United States, and they've spread everywhere. You can see them in all over the country.
Now it's 1900, and we have the whole 20th century, and this continues, this stocking of the fish continues throughout the 20th century, and it's being done under the auspices of government, under the auspices of state or federal or private concerns. How does it continue and develop throughout the 20th century?
Well, it becomes it takes on a really epic scale. So in 1962, they poisoned the Green River Basin above Flaming Gorge. That's basically the southwest quadrant of Wyoming. It's a watershed of about 15,000 square miles. That's to put that in perspective. That's something along the lines of Connecticut and Massachusetts combined. They poisoned that entire river system to kill all of the native and wild fish that were there so that it would be safe for them to stock rainbow trout. Now, I didn't mention this earlier, but rainbow trout are only native to the Pacific Rim, from Mexico up around through California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, around to actually to Kamchatka in Russia. But it's a very narrow band that they're native to. They aren't native to the interior west or the east or most of the country. But they wanted to make this Green River safe for rainbow trout that they planned to introduce because, of course, for the reasons we discussed earlier, the world was enamored with rainbow trout at this point. So they poisoned out all of these fish. It was a massive operation. Thousands of gallons of this fish poison called rotenone sprayed from tubes, from helicopters, from airboats. And what's most amazing about that story to me is I went and looked through all the newspapers expecting to find enormous stories all over the place about this big operation that they were doing. And there were virtually none up until the time the operation occurred. The only place you can find newspaper stories about it was in the sports section of some of the local papers. Because they were so proud of the fact that the fishing was going to be so good. They were worried that these other fish would eat the rainbow trout that they were stocking into the stream and or compete with them for resources. So they figured if they got rid of all these other fish, there would be no competition and no predation for the rainbow trout.
But the rainbow trout itself is a fairly voracious fish and is a threat to other organisms in an ecosystem or a river or a lake.
Yes, it certainly is. It certainly can be. It's created enormous problems on its own. So you can flash forward even now to the present day, and what I just described going on in the Green River has sort of, the tables have been turned, and now people are trying actually to remove rainbow trout. But ironically, we've spent more than $100 million now trying to recover some of the native fish that they were poisoning out in the Green River in 1962. And a consequence of that 1962 poisoning actually was it sort of indirectly led to the 1973 Endangered Species Act, because there was an enormous outcry after the fact, because some of the dead fish and some of the poison got down into Dinosaur National Monument, and people considered that sacred ground due to some earlier battles that had occurred over that. And so Stuart Udall, who was the new Secretary of Interior, set up a committee on rare and threatened species and established the principle that we should always take native species into account and prioritize them with any operations that we're doing on federal lands or with federal money. Ultimately, that committee led to the 1973 Endangered Species Act, and that in turn has meant that we've now started to poison out rainbow trout to try to restore these native fish.
At one point, back into the middle of the 20th century, we were stocking rainbow trout by dropping them out of airplanes into lakes that couldn't otherwise be reached. Is that true?
Yes, and that's quite a story, too. So what happened was you had a lot of leftover military aircraft and a lot of bomber pilots after World War II. And these guys, you know, they were the can-do generation, and a few of them decided to see what would happen if they started using these airplanes, these surplus military aircraft, to drop fish into lakes. And it's the things they did are really amazing. They started out by dropping them in buckets, and on their first try, it was in an old milk can. On their first try, they missed the pond that they were trying to hit, and instead bounced down some concrete nearby. And when they landed, they found the fish were still alive in this bucket. And so they decided this was a no-brainer, that if they could survive that, they could survive a nice fall into a lake. And so within a few years, they found that They could drop fish directly out of these airplanes into lakes, and it was a much cheaper proposition than what they had been doing before. Some of these lakes had been stocked by mules or by carrying the fish up in backpacks. And so many of these lakes that used to be out of reach were now being stocked on a massive and ongoing basis, not just in California where it began, but that technique spread all over the country. And it goes on to this day.
And are we trying to regulate the population of rainbow trout? You're saying that they're trying to get rid of some of them to restore the balance with the native species. Do we have programs that measure those results?
Well, it's become actually extremely controversial right at this moment now in California. In 2006, a group of Stanford Law School students on behalf of two environmental groups sued the California Department of Fish and Game because they said they needed to do an environmental impact report under California law for all of the stocking that they were doing. And California Department of Fish and Game agreed to write this environmental impact report about their stocking activities, so that needed to take into account what effect the stocking might have. And they just issued that report on January 11th, and I know several people who think that it was an unsatisfactory report, so we're probably going to see a lawsuit and quite a bit of controversy in the fishing community over it. So what are the impacts of stocking fish in these high lakes all over the place? There's two. First of all, many of these lakes were fishless. They after the glaciers retreated 10, 12,000 years ago, there were barrier waterfalls that prevented any fish from getting up to these lakes. So a whole fauna developed and evolved there that were naive about what fierce predators fish could be. Some of them, for example, in California, the big one is the mountain yellow-legged frog, which has been in serious decline for many years and is now really reaching a point of, some question about whether it'll make it or go extinct in the next few decades. And these fish are such fierce predators. You can imagine a naive little tadpole swimming out around this lake and a rainbow trout drops in from the air. It's a feast for the rainbow trout and a disaster for the fish. So the first of all, there's native species like frogs, invertebrates, any of the mayflies or things that live there. They get that whole fauna changes dramatically. But the other interesting thing that happens from stocking rainbow trout, they can hybridize. And this is maybe one of the biggest threats from rainbow trout of all. They hybridize with the native cutthroats. This can lead to extinction through hybridization. In fact, it already has for a couple of different species. The cutthroat is a species of trout that's closely related to rainbow trout. So what happens is these rainbows, now they've been spread so far and wide and they've hybridized with all the cutthroats. And now you've got these hybrids swimming around and mating with any pure cutthroats that are left. And you've sort of got rainbow genes moving on their own throughout these river systems now and eventually wiping out any pure cutthroats that might be left. So there's a number of different ways in which these trout can affect the native ecosystem.
You end your book, Anders, with a point about humility, the lesson that we learn from unintended consequences, the wish to promote and propagate species 100 years ago has now met with a contrary motion. So how do we balance the public good?
Yeah, I think that really is how I ended this book, having read so much of the rhetoric that they put out in the 19th century about what a wonderful thing they were doing for mankind by spreading these fish all over the country and all over the world. And they were so sure of themselves. And it reminds me of some of the rhetoric that you see today about people who are so eager to, whatever their cause may be, whether it's restoring the natives or whatever else it may be. And so I really do come to this conclusion that who knows what they're going to think in 100 years about whatever restoration efforts we take on today. So let's be humble and careful about it as we go about it.
Thank you, Anders Halvorsen, for talking with us today about how the rainbow trout beguiled America and overran the world. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News. Copyright Bloomberg 2010.